want to say, it has been such a delight to be with you. I feel as if I can't walk two steps without having a meaningful conversation. And that's not always the case when I visit somewhere. You know, there's a sense of, we've all been in that place where we're on sort of professional best behavior, and we're trying our best to do what people hope we can offer. That's not how I'm feeling. I'm feeling like I'm a part of you, and I'm welcome, and I'm learning, and you are richly attending to the conversation I'm encouraging, but also conversations that you already are living, and it's just been incredible. So thank you. A quick commentary related to some of those side conversations. I've had a couple of good, meaningful, deeper reflections with some of you about under the broad rubric of the use of social media in the church or by people who are leaders in the church. And I want to be sure that we don't leave here with my having taken shortcuts that would not be helpful. So I think the true rule of life that I want to be sure to communicate very, very clearly to you and back to myself about us being in any of the digitally mediated spaces that are now available to us, particularly forms of social media, is that we must be present in those spaces as we choose to be present, as the people we are in real time. The way I interact online needs to be as congruent with the person I want to be and I'm called to be and I'm working to be in my embodied flesh in this room. And that seems so obvious, but it is so easy through kind of the seeming neutrality of whatever the device is and the medium is to sort of blast when we feel particularly exacerbated. It's so easy to just push send before we have stopped and thought just for a moment about what this message will really reveal between the words, between the lines, between the symbols, about ourselves and about that which we represent. So I am not a person who lives terrified, period, I hope, but particularly in terms of social media, we're gonna make mistakes. The one thing is we can't break the internet, okay? You can't be so bad at doing something with digital technology that it's all gonna crash because of you, unless you're really smart. So I don't think that should be your worry, and I don't think that we should be any more afraid in the domains of social mediated conversation that God cannot forgive. Of course God can forgive, and we can change our ways. But it is a powerful medium, and I commend us as lay and clergy leaders of the church to honor it and to respect the people who are watching us there in the same way I hope you respect the members of your congregations, the colleagues with whom you work, the families with whom you interact. It's very unbecoming of Christians, period, to be engaged in social media in ways that you and I would not choose to be engaged in front of our grandmothers. You know, it's not becoming to be engaged in social media in ways that do not honor God and celebrate the good news that is inherent in our journey. So that doesn't mean everything you send has to be pious, not at all. But it does mean that's not the place to diss your bishop. That's not the place to say, my clergy group sucks. That's not the place to say, you know, nothing I do is appreciated by my congregation, and I don't know what the deal is. But I can't think of good examples, but they're out there. And find your best friend, find a spouse, find a spiritual director, find a journal, find a place to go take a wonderful hike and renew your body and soul. Find a pillow to punch, find a peace ball if you have to punch it. Find something that is not putting words into a digital space that we can rarely retrieve. It's just not good witness. It's not who we want to be. So I don't need to preach to you, I think, but all of us have made small and or larger mistakes in that arena, and I am so excited about the resources of our current technologies for ministry that I get very sad when the sort of wet blanket of fear gets thrown over all of them, because honestly, there are incredible practices that are growing the church and are making disciples using digitally mediated technology. And we need to honor those, and it's like anything. We need to tell the good stories as a way, it's the assets of the field of digital ministry that will help us grow and will help us learn. It's not the deficits, right? So live not in fear, but practice self-discipline. And with that, I want to commend you. I mentioned this briefly yesterday. Our annual E-Formation Conference at Virginia Seminary is coming up June 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. It's on the campus. There are two ways of participating. You can come to 1 day, 2 days, or 3 days. So you can register for 1, 2, or 3 days. The first day being focused primarily on digital media for communications and congregational and church life. The second day being what we call our boot camp, a day when we give you a chance to choose literally hands-on workshops about all the kinds of digital tools that you might want to know more about. How do I know about the Google platforms? How do I know how to use my smartphone to make video and then transfer it into some other useful form? If you know about Apple and the Genius Bar, we have an equivalent Genius Bar set up throughout the conference, so when you are literally stuck, you can go up to somebody who says, and say, I don't know how to make this work, please help me. So it's hands-on laboratory learning. First day communication, second day particularly focused on what we call our boot camp skills, and the third day specifically focused on digital media for formation. So you can do the whole conference, you can do a day of the conference. We also have, you can participate in the conference online. So there are channels of the conference that will be live streamed. So you can register as a webinar for this conference, and you can register for 1 day, 2 days, or 3 days of sitting where you live and move and have your being at home, and watch us and participate in live time in a chat function with a conversation in the classroom that's being taught. It's also going to have a strong Spanish language track. So during the days, there will be several workshops that are translated simultaneously into Spanish for people whose first language is Spanish. And in the evenings, our strongest digital communicators in the Episcopal Church in digital ministry are offering an all-Spanish track for people involved in Latino-Hispanic ministry. That is for English speakers and Spanish language speakers. It will be taught in Spanish, but the translation will be in English. So if you are in a community where it might be useful to know more about digital media and Latino ministry, I would invite you, encourage you to come and participate in that evening stream if that's convenient. And that too will be webinar. There'll be a webinar form. So if you go to eformationvts.edu, or if someone in your congregation or your school or your ministry setting would like to know more about digital media, I commend it to you. It's really fun. And many of you have been there. I mean, it's not that they're all expert and you sit passively. It's very much a participatory conference. You're really welcome. Thank you, Danielle. It's going to be fun. And we're learning. And the first year we did this, I insisted that we try to do this bilingually. And it's been challenging. But some of the smartest leadership for this conference has come from our Latino communities, including Province 9 of the Episcopal Church. There is some incredible work being done with digital media between nations, between countries, because the Episcopal Church in Province 9 is so geographically dispersed, but they have common concern. And they have become so digitally savvy that they are using tools with no budgets to equip lay people with theological education. It's incredible. Okay. Little review here. We have one mission, right? To restore all people to unity with God and each other in Christ. And as I said yesterday, I hope, and pretty clearly, I think it's an awesome mission. And it's a mission that we continue to try to live into more fully. Too often, I believe, unfortunately, it is a mission we do well with a club. And we do not necessarily remember people beyond those who have found their way to us. If you've heard conversations with me in this past year or so, I've really been on this epic mission conversation trail. I've been talking about the fact that as Christians and Episcopalians in particular, I think we are on the ultimate epic journey. And there's a reason you can't read this slide. It's because I think our ultimate epic journey is often lost in the cacophony of the worlds in which we live, in the noises of distraction, whether they are in the church or outside the church. I think our epic journey, our good news, is not yet accessible to the people who might most want to hear it. Our epic journey, which is up here but hard to hear and hard to see, Christ has died, Christ is risen, and Christ will come again. That promise of resurrection, that we will be with God, that God will return to this earth to make all things whole, and that we are called into that maker generation of making things right is the ultimate, ultimate invitation for meaningful, purposeful living. And my other favorite slide, and many of you will have seen this if you've been around me this last year, that I had to figure out a way to get it in because I just can't stand not doing this, is that if our journey is epic, and if it has that arc of a classic epic, which is this adventure, this sense of a hero's journey, that there is an ultimate goal that is challenging and just out of reach, but possible, we're losing out in very, very practical ways. Two things like your Old Spice deodorant. This is my favorite slide. So on the back of your current Old Spice, how many of you happen to have Old Spice deodorant on your shelf and you could actually go check me out at home? Okay, a few of us, this is awesome. Okay, go back and check what you've got on the back of it. It says, in larger print than anything else, contains odor-fighting atomic robots that shoot lasers at your stench monsters and replaces them with fresh, clean, masculine scent elves. Contains odor-fighting atomic robots that shoot lasers at your stench monsters and replaces them with fresh, clean, masculine scent elves. Does your mission statement on your website get you that excited? Are you ready to do this with your mission statement? Okay. I mean, this is funny, it's awesome, it's great, who cares? You know, I happen to use this deodorant. I'm not a boy, but I think it's great because it's, you know, I'm of that generation where I was told if you use antiperspirant, it gives you cancer, so you don't do that. And I don't know if it's true, but I still use, you know. So, hence my discovery. Now, did I buy it because it said that? No. But do I keep buying it because it says that? Yes. So we need to get to the point where our people hear our invitation to this epic adventure that we are on in that kind of bold, radical, crazy, transformative language. Right? We need to do this. So we have surprising allies. I think the time is right. I mean, this is the good news. There is so much right with the world. While yesterday was spent sort of reminding us that there's a lot that yet needs work, there's a lot right with the world, including other people who are surprising allies coming toward us. I don't know if any of you have had a chance to read David Brooks's newest book yet. So David Brooks, New York Times columnist, commentator, self-identified narcissist, all sorts of good stuff about David Brooks. Smart man, moderate Republican, Jewish of origin, heritage, and practicing, wrote the book called The Road to Character. And the opening lines in his most recent book say, "Recently, I've been thinking about the difference between the resume virtues and the eulogy virtues. The resume virtues are the ones you list on your resume, the skills that bring you to the job market and that contribute to external success. The eulogy virtues are deeper. They're the virtues that get talked about at your funeral, the ones that exist at the core of your being, whether you are kind, brave, honest, or faithful, what kind of relationships you form." That's our work, right? Helping people understand their eulogy virtues, live into their being made in the image of God. They're living into the capacity that is superhuman. It doesn't take deodorant to make us superhuman. It takes God and the baptismal font to make us superhuman. Our job is to help people know whose they are and how their gifts are needed in the world. And people like David Brooks, whose book continues by walking through the profiles of leaders who live with deep character, is a book that reminds us that we can form people who have the courage to lead and to help form others in purposeful, generous, sacrificial lives. He goes on to say, "Our education system is certainly oriented around the resume virtues more than the eulogy ones. Public conversation is too. The self-help tips in magazines, the nonfiction bestsellers. Most of us have clearer strategies for how to achieve career success than for how to develop a profound character." We've got work to do. You know, he's saying most of us, and I don't think he's wrong. I think we have a whole world, and just take your neighborhood, your local community, the largest percentage of which are people who are yearning to have purposeful, meaningful lives and know at some deep level, like the bumper sticker says, they can't take their toys with them when they die, right? And they know that, but they don't know how to get from here to there with peace. So they continue to acquire, they continue to compete, they continue to be anxious about not being good enough. And we have a promise that says, you are worthy. God knew you before you were born. God called you by name. You are worthy. You are good. You are whole. You may have to make some changes. There are ways you could be healthier and more worthy, but you can't be any more worthy than God already sees you. So let's look for allies. Let's build on common currency in terms of what people are already reading, watching, listening to. Similarly, do you remember the FACT study, the Faith Communities Today study that came out of Hartford Seminary in 2010? It was an ecumenical study of church, the health of the church, basically. There is aggregated data and there's disaggregated data, which means you can look at it across denominations and you can look at it by denominationally specific data. What they found in the Episcopal data, not surprisingly, is that our congregations were declining in size. Our congregations were overall less healthy. One of the findings that was very revealing, but again, not surprising if we're honest, is that there is persistent conflict in at least a third of our congregations. Persistent kind of bubbling unhappiness, often maybe parking lot level, not necessarily explosive, but enough that it's keeping new visitors, new people, at the margins or away. They can tell when we're not a happy people. But here's something that I think we can turn on its head and be very hopeful. So in this FACT study, this is oddly worded, but it's their wording, the congregations that were least likely to say these following things characterized their worship very well, okay? So only 4% of our congregations characterized their worship as innovative. Only 17% of our congregations who were surveyed characterized their worship as inspirational. And only 23% characterized their worship as thought-provoking. Now, why do I go to worship immediately? Well, because we are a people of the book, right? We are people who confidently believe that our common life is organized around worship. We know that coming together around the sacraments is what makes us who we are. Coming to the table together on a regular basis is what is intended to redeem and feed us and send us back out into the world to do the work God has given us to do. We believe, you know, the lex orandi, lex credendi promise that how we pray, you know, what we believe comes from the law of praying. So we need to do our worship well. Why this is important is because it goes on to talk about the fact that what makes worship innovative has a relationship to how churches grow. These four columns along the bottom are going to talk about how innovative or contemporary worship is. And the vertical column is the percent of congregations that self-identified through these rigorous means as what they call high spiritual vitality. Congregations that are spiritually vital grow. Congregations that are spiritually vital are not fighting. Congregations that are spiritually vital deal with real issues in real time. What this tells us, which is really hopeful, the bluest column on the bottom left, the short stubby column, which says 17.4% of those congregations are spiritually vital, so not many of them, right? Those are congregations that by measurement are neither innovative nor contemporary, okay? So they're stuck. They're not changing anything, they're not imagining anything new, and they're just kind of doing it the way they've always done it. And they're not perceived by current members or visitors as contemporary in one way or another. The pinkish column, the second one from the left, is the contemporary but not innovative. So these are folks that are trying some new stuff. They've plugged in a guitar, they're using a projector, they've translated the language into inclusive language. They're doing something in the midst of their liturgy, right? 23.2% of those congregations measure as spiritually vital. The third column, the green one, innovative and not contemporary. Okay? This might be a right one congregation, It's not contemporary, but it's innovative. It's doing something within the tradition that is innovating and engaging people such that 38% of those congregations are spiritually vital. Do you hear where I'm going? You don't have to be, this is not advocating for wild change that is beyond the traditional culture of your congregation. It's inviting you to imagine within the strengths of your congregation how you can be more innovative. So who might lead the prayers of the people in a traditional congregation makes a difference. Is it all clergy driven? How are lay people engaged? How do you use your space? Who can see? Who can't see? Do you have children? Can they literally not see the movements of the liturgy? How do you maintain the decorum of your tradition, but innovate in such a way that people start to engage it, to feel it, to value it, to understand it? Is it that they like the feeling, but they don't really understand it? How might you annotate your bulletin so that there are little inserted boxes that explain something that traditionally is only in Latin? How might you add something in your forum after church that is an engaging way for people to ask safe questions and still honor the liturgy as the tradition it is? The tallest column, 46.7% of innovation and more contemporary, is the place where more congregations are experiencing high spiritual vitality. Now, contemporary does not have to mean wildly different music. It does not have to mean you project everything. It could mean you're a paperless service if that's organic and authentic and appropriate to your congregation. But what you can do when you innovate and you are contemporary can be as real as bringing in current events in the forum and the preaching of your congregation. It can be the music you choose. The piece of music we just sang, this last piece of music in the morning prayer, was new to me. I thought it was beautiful. That's a form of innovation, and it's a more contemporary piece of music. So you can invite innovation very gradually, and you can bring in contemporary flavor without abandoning the tradition, the container. Excuse me. I'm at the end of one of those colds that sort of just does its thing. Another source that I've drawn from that's also an older source. Do you remember Leonard Sweet's book that hit the market some time ago? The Gospel According to Starbucks. Remember this? The subtitle was Living with a Grande Passion. He was one of the first people who was kind of bridging the church secular world of innovation and management theory change. And he talked about a lot of different things. But one of the things that he identified that he learned from places like Starbucks is our worship can be transformational. And what I like about it is he used the language of epic. Our worship can, in fact, change people's lives in the way that Starbucks has changed our lives. Starbucks created a need we didn't even know we had, right? Starbucks personalizes your experience. If you go to your local Starbucks more than twice, they'll start to know your beverage of choice. They'll start to call you by name. They'll start to individualize the experience. They'll start to make you feel like you're a customer that matters. Why? Because going to Starbucks and our liturgies need to be epic in his language. And the way he defines epic is experiential, participatory, imagistic, and connective. Experiential means, and we are these people, right? We are a sensate people. We are a tradition that values all of that. Our worship, when it will be transformational, when it will be formative, when it will be engaging of people of all ages, allows our full-bodied experience of what it is we are claiming and what it is we are doing. So it involves stand, kneel, sit. It involves smells when that's appropriate. Flowers, not just incense, right? It involves tactile experience of space and books and the bread of Christ, you know, the body of Christ as a something in your hand, holding a chalice. It involves visual and engaging imagery. One of the rich traditions of our particular brand of Christianity is that we have incredibly rich art in our buildings, in our tradition, in the texts we use. So how is it all experiential? How is it imagistic? How do we participate in liturgy? We talk about liturgy being the work of the people, and too many churches are still driven by the work of the clergy. You know, being a Christian who's a layperson in many of our churches is a very passive experience. We are invited to go sit somewhere, we're handed a bulletin, and then we just sort of watch and we know when to stand and when we sit. You think we're participating because we're sort of singing, but I would sing better if I knew why we picked the hymns we pick, or if I got to give feedback about why we picked the hymns we pick, or if we were able to actually pray the prayers of the people that are my prayers, not just race through the six recommended, you know, variations of the prayers of the people. The six forms in the prayer book were just guidelines, right? They're there to help us know what it is we should be praying for. How can a congregation participate in its prayer life? By learning to write the prayers of the people, and by learning to speak them or chant them if it's a musical congregation. There are so many ways to do what we do well and do it better. The connective piece of EPIC is that going to church, going to Starbucks, is an opportunity to be more connected to other human beings, to be more connected to people on the journey, sharing this curiosity, this wonder, this awe, this fear, this uncertainty about following the way of Jesus. We assume that because we're in the building together or we're at school together. But unless we find ways to give people a chance to reflect on that together, we actually do not help connect. You know, if you did the honest study of your congregation or your school and said, how well do people connect when they're not here physically together? Some of us might be very disappointed. You know, how well they actually reach out to each other and support each other in the informal moments in that life-wide formation that I'm talking about. The more we teach that, the more we model that, the more formation is not just our job. So this is also very contemporary. Rachel Held Evans, how many of you know her? Terrific. What do you know about her? Evangelical, became an Episcopalian. What'd you say? She wrote a column in the Post, right? In Sunday's Post. And the title was, Want Millennials Back in the Pews? Do you remember what the subtitle was, basically? Stop trying to be cool. She said, stop trying to make church cool. Here's a direct quote from her. Recent research from the Barna Group, which is some of what I was giving you yesterday, and the Cornerstone Knowledge Network, found that 67% of millennials prefer a classic church over a trendy one, and 77% would choose a sanctuary over an auditorium. While we have yet to warm to the word traditional, only 40% favor it over modern, millennials exhibit an increasing aversion to exclusive, closed-minded religious communities, masquerading as the hip new places in town. For a generation bombarded with advertising and sales pitches, and for whom the charge of inauthentic is as cutting an insult as any, church rebranding efforts can actually backfire, especially when young people sense that there is more emphasis on marketing Jesus than actually following him. Millennials are not disillusioned with tradition. They are frustrated with slick or shallow expressions of religion, argues David Kinnaman, who interviewed hundreds of them for the Barna Group and compiled his research in the book some of you know, You Lost Me, Why Young Christians Are Leaving the Church. That was that list I gave you yesterday. And Rethinking Faith is his subtitle. In the words of another blogger that she quotes, Amy Peterson, at church, I do not want to be entertained. I do not want to be the target of anyone's marketing. I want to be asked to participate in the life of an ancient future community. An ancient future community. I believe seriously, and this is not just, you know, my own genetic bias, the Episcopal Church is so perfectly positioned to be that for all people, but particularly for the nuns, the duns, the unchurched, the whatever you want to call it, millennial generation. We have elders who are living longer, who have stories of faith to share. We have beautiful sanctuary spaces. We have traditions that are sturdy and enduring. We have a sacramental tradition that allows people to experience the mystery of silence and the wonder of the Eucharist. We have so much, and we are so anxiously practicing it with the few that have found their way in. How can we take all of that wonderful promise into the worlds that young adults inhabit? And I know many of you are doing this, but we need to do it further. This is a short video from the Hillel organization, the campus ministry for the Jewish communities. I think it just reminds us of something else we as Anglicans can do very well.
When was your last truly great conversation? That life-changing conversation? Where you saw the world differently? Where your own world got just a little bit bigger? How often do we have conversations like that? Or recognize and appreciate all the possibilities that came from them? The paths we took? The people who entered our lives? The communities we built? And all of the ripple effects as a result? Great conversations change our world. They help us see the bigger picture in our everyday lives. And they start with asking big questions. College is the time for great conversations. It's our time to discover the world. It's our time to discover who we are. Across North America, diverse groups of students are making time to have great, intentional conversations about life, relationships, purpose, and community, about the things that connect us rather than divide us, to understand each other and understand ourselves at the same time. Can we change the world through great conversations? We believe we can. All you have to do is ask. Ask big questions. www.askbigquestions.org.
It's a great promo for campus ministry, and I commend it to you. But I think church is the place also to ask big questions. I think that what people assume who are in our membership and who might be on the perimeter of our experience actually assume that we all have the answers. We don't have the answers. Some of us have clues. Some of us have hints. We have traditions to draw from. What we have are the spiritual practices that allow us to engage the possibility of coming to understand more fully. That's what people need, are the tools to understand how to pray, how to read scripture, how to do good in the world, how to love justice, how to love mercy. That's what we need to offer people. So in the words of my favorite 20th century educator, John Dewey, who was famous for working with the progressive education movement, his tomes of writing, our trends are sort of reduced to stop and think. He's the father of what we would say today is 21st century educational theory around experiential learning, and the idea that in order to learn, we need to stop and reflect on what we already have experienced. So John says stop and think. This New York Times cartoon, it says at the bottom, it sort of makes you stop and think, doesn't it? Kind of the point. So, you know, I want you to be thinking as I go forward about sort of what are the pressing challenges and the exciting opportunities in your particular context, your congregation, your school, that invite the kind of imaginative formation enriching possibilities that I'm proposing. You won't be able to see these from far away, but they're my point to you that everything I'm trying to do with you from yesterday through today is practicing, I hope, in this room, what I hope you will then practice at home, which is a model of experiential learning. On the left is what is often the Kolb model, the more traditional model. The top says concrete experience leads to reflective observation, leads to abstract conceptualization, leads to active experimentation. Basically, we do something. When we want to learn about it, we stop and think about what we just did. Then we think, well, how did that, does that relate to what I already knew? So let's think about something goes wrong in your house. A drain is plugged up. And you think, I could just pour a liquid plumber down the drain, but I know that's not good for the environment. So what are my options? I could go get a plunger. So I go get a plunger, and I try to plunge. It's a little bit better, but it's not a whole lot better. What else could I do? I go on the internet. I search on YouTube. Stuck drains, natural cures. I don't know. What are your key search terms, right? I get a couple of other ideas. It says pour something really random down, like baking soda. Or I don't know what it'll say. You try that, right? It works better. So that becomes your active experimentation for the next time. And it says, what are the things to prevent it? Well, you put a little drain cover in so it catches some of the extra hair. I mean, you start to learn how to keep your drain clear and how to sustain that. So the next time, you are more efficient in that process. On the right is another model of experiential learning that I find really helpful. It's from a woman called Laura Joplin. And what she basically says, and it's all built on the same theory, is that In life, we have a series of events unfolding, some of them intentional, some of them not intentional. But we learn richly in what she calls a moment of challenging action. It looks like a hurricane in this picture. We learn best if you and I are trying to help other people learn and we are planning something for them. It may be a liturgy, it may be a class, it may be a series of experiences, it may be a young parents group, it may be something we're doing online with them. The challenging action is the it, right? But people will learn from the it better if we do something to help them focus before they engage it. So if you're going to have a sermon series that you think is really important for the life of your congregation, a thematic series, what can you do to help the congregation be ready for it, to focus on it? How can you season them? How can you tease it up? Is it telling them things for weeks ahead of time in announcements? Is it putting things in some e-newsletter? Is it putting things on your website? Is it little flyers around the building? Is it something in the coffee hour? Is it curious questions? How do you just begin to change the environment so people are wondering, what's this going to be? Or they've read something before you start talking about it. So they have bring to the experience a readiness and an openness and some experience of anticipation, right? You have the challenging action, whatever that is. And some of them are planned like I'm describing, and some of them are just spontaneous, oops. How many of us are taking young people on a trip, a mission trip, a pilgrimage, a summer camp, and something went terribly wrong, like the bus didn't show up, right? Challenging actions can be learning experiences when we are prepared for them in ways that we have anticipated. Okay, things could go wrong, so what am I going to be ready for? But when they have the challenging action, it is itself a learning experience, and it may be transformative in the moment for many people. But like this conference, not just my portion of it, all of it, you will learn more from being together for these 3 days if you take time to debrief, to reflect on it with others who were here, with people you work with people you live with. If you take time to put your experience here into your own language and begin to say, I don't know that I agreed with that, or that really made me think and got me excited. I'm going to look into that or read more or see more or do more. Debriefing. So the basic flow, focus, challenging action, debrief. As the formers of faith, the teachers, the educators, the supporters of people's transformative learning, we need to provide 2 things. The lower line says support, and the upper line says feedback. None of us can learn when we're scared. If you think about a ropes course, right? If you've ever done that or watched a ropes course, high-level ropes, you know, all this great intention. You can learn about leadership. You can learn about yourself. You can learn about trust. All this, rah, 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 rah. I'm not going to climb no rope to the top of some little pole and jump off into the nowhere, never, never land if I don't believe that I'm going to be supported, right? And even if I believe I'm going to be supported and I've got all of my belay equipment and I'm all hitched in and I've practiced all the things and I start to climb and I'm going up to the top of this little wobbly thing and I'm supposed to like be all confident, I am not likely to jump off it ever if somebody on the ground isn't giving me some decent feedback and saying, Lisa, you're doing really well. Lisa, that's great. Can you see the thing just ahead? Just reach a little higher, you'll find a hook. Lisa, take a breath. You don't need to rush. It's okay. You're doing great. You're going to be, you're further than you've ever been. This is awesome. If you come down now, that's fine, but you can do it, right? I need feedback. Now, that's literal time certain feedback on a particular task. But too often in the church, we do not form people well because we ask them to do something and we give them no feedback. Even if it's stuffing envelopes in your church office, thank you is important. But giving them feedback about, you did that faster than I've ever seen anybody do that. What did you do that works so well? I'd love to pass that on to somebody else. Or do you know how helpful it is that you can come and be here on a Thursday afternoon when very few other people are available? This gets something in the, you know, whatever the feedback is, help people grow in their skills, their understanding, how their little bit part fits with the big picture. That kind of valuing of people's time and integrity is what gives them formative opportunity. So these challenging actions, this cycle, happens continually, and it happens over time. So you can think about this model as applied to a particular Sunday forum, and you can think about this model over 6 months of an adult education series. How are you focusing? How are you challenging? How are you debriefing? And the debriefing then leads into the next focusing exercise. The more we reflect on who we are, the better we are at teaching other people about it. Do you remember the Trek report last year? What's it stand for? Reimagining the Episcopal Church. What's the T? Task Force for Reimagining. Thank you, Bishop. That Task Force for Reimagining. So Dwight Shiley, who is a professor at Luther Seminary and Episcopal priest, led this project. And the qualities that they gathered from all of the survey work and all of the reading and all of the knowledge about our church that make us distinctly who we are. I'm sorry this isn't darker. Episcopal identity is rooted in an expansive and generous spirit. Episcopal identity is rooted in the incarnation. We are incarnational people. It is sacramental. It is rooted in what he has, arts, mystery, beauty. The sense of the aesthetic, that we recognize that our God is revealed to us through beauty, through creativity, through imagination. Episcopal identity is rooted in social engagement and prophetic discernment. Dissent, thank you. Discernment gets to dissent, but thank you for correcting that. That's important, actually, that we are willing, rooted in our faith, to speak truth to power, that we are willing to call the question on things that we see in our lives that are unjust. And Episcopal identity is rooted in continuity and change, the stability and the inevitability of change. The fact that there is regular rhythm of knowing where we came from and where we are going in the hands of the God. Those identity features are things, again, that link back to what we have to offer a world that feels very unstable, is very uncertain, is violently disrupted. We have so much to offer in the core of our being as the people of God walking the way of Jesus in the Episcopal tradition. As many of you know, that work that I mentioned yesterday from Willow Creek Community Church, the Reveal Study, has now been made available to other denominational groups. And Jay Sidebotham, a priest of our church, now is the director of an organization called Renewal Works. And Renewal Works has taken and is using the instrument that Bill Hybels and his research team developed. And Episcopal churches all over our country have now used that instrument to discern and determine what is the health of their congregation, how well are they forming faith, how well are they making Christians and sustaining Christian life in the life of that congregation. And Renewal Works is taking those Episcopal identity factors and building them into the consulting services they provide to help congregations become more fully who God calls them to be where they are. Another great resource, Episcopal Foundation's Vital Practices. Many of you, I'm sure, know of these resources. They have a blog, they post regularly, they have videos, they have print materials that are designed to equip lay people in local congregations to do what they are called to do well. They now have translation and full Spanish resources. A friend, Sandra Montes, is now there's a staff person with them. They are advocating for and developing ground-up resources for congregational development in Latino communities. What it is particularly helpful for are vestry members, for leaders of committees and councils, whether you have them or not, you have lay people who take leadership and initiative. This is a way of saying to them, you have skills, and those skills are valuable, and they're tied to your faith, and this is a set of resources to support you in knowing that what you do matters, and the church values it. So I commend those resources to you. They're free. You can subscribe. So it's ecfvp.org, Episcopal Church Foundation, vitalpractices.org. So who are the people to whom we're called to pass on these core principles of faith? I hope there are people you know well, and I hope that there are people who you do not yet know well. We need to decide. We can't each of us know everyone. We can't make disciples of all people in the immediate present, but we can help all of us continue to grow lifelong and life-wide more fully. But the reality is, as Rick Osmer, a colleague and practical theologian friend of mine, says, he says, congregations are competing in a spiritual marketplace for individuals who define their relationship to the church in terms of their own issues and needs. Now, some of us just think and get sour about this and say they're selfish Everything's individualistic. You know, everybody wants it their way. They don't want to come to church because it's not convenient. Well, the other way of looking at it is, because we have a world that is digitally mediated, because we have a world that is basically a pay-as-you-go world, folks are conditioned now, for better or for worse, to recognize that there are alternatives. They're shopping for what will feed them best, what will meet their needs most immediately. Without selling our souls, we can personalize what it is that we are offering our congregations and the people we're trying to reach. So what this says is that we have people of all different shapes and sizes, and there are resources, activities, teaching, God encounters, community experiences, and worship that can be appropriate for all of them if they understand what we're making available. What we assume right now is that one size fits all. We assume adult education is a course, a program, and that it will meet the needs of all people 25 to 85. That's not realistic. So what we need to do is say, this particular offering is really going to be optimal for these people. And this other kind of resource that we want to promote is going to be more optimal for someone else. We need to be willing to say, there are things we do intentionally together, intergenerationally, and there are things that we do in particular special interest groups or age-specific groups. You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. So this is what in the church we often call parallel development. It's Buckminster Fuller's wisdom, but it is absolutely true. Don't tell somebody something's not good and it's broken if they love it. Just start to do something else that will invite other people into relationship with the work you're doing. And allow people to make choices. We are agents of free will. God has gifted us with that capacity. But if you build new things, new opportunities that you have a passion for, that are appropriate for the context you're in, people will choose toward that. It's the way we do parallel development in congregations. We nurture the old and we build the new. People change what they do less because they are given analysis that shifts their thinking than because they are shown a truth that influences their feelings. So whatever it is that I've shared with you, lots of head stuff, trust where your heart is responding. Trust what it is that you believe is most authentically a part of your gift, your capacity, your understanding, and follow that. So in this world of change, in this world of people who are looking for what will meet their particular needs, we're also facing a lot of what we call adaptive challenges. There are a lot of things happening that are just this landscape I tried to lay out for you yesterday. The people we want to reach, both in our congregations and churches and schools and communities, and the people beyond it, have this lifespan diversity, right? We have children all the way through much older, old adults. We have generational diversity. We have very different preferences based on our generations. We have family diversities. We have live in households now that don't all look alike, and we call them our family. We have religious and spiritual diversity. We have ethnic and cultural diversities. We have language diversity. We have economic diversity. We have educational diversity, which means that the images I use in a sermon are more appropriate for some people than other people. We have to recognize that there is constantly this challenge to be authentically ourselves, individually and corporately, and recognize that some of what we are being will not be appropriate for some of the diversities around us. And instead of pretending that we can be all things to all people, how do we mobilize resources for the people we are not able to speak to directly? How do we find ways to build allies for them, build resources, tell others about who's in your community, so that there is something for all people? It may not all be at St. Swithin's. There are adaptive challenges that we face. What used to be very group-centered life has become network-centered. So groups were church, home, the sort of primary ethnic culture that we were a part of, and our neighborhood. Those places of affiliation that built our suburbs, those places of affiliation that built our social institutions, they are gradually and rather quickly in some ways and for some generations being replaced by network-centered life. People are finding their likeness online. They're building networks across the globe that bring together people of the same wondering, the same question, the same particular interest in a particular, you know, bird watchers are avid internet users because they can find bird watchers all over the world who talk their language, and you can give them real-time evidence that if they can get their butt in the car and drive to this other place, they will see the one bird that's been on their list for 20 years, right? They're not online because they love technology. They're online because online life, networked life with bird watching, gives them new possibilities of access and understanding. So these adaptive challenges that we are facing mean that there is an ongoing shift from formal education, which was often expert-centered, somewhat static, often in a physical gathered place, to learning anywhere, anytime. That's what is happening with the internet, with you know, what we call now the highly digitally mediated, hyper-driven world that we live in. You and I know we can go online and look for things that we don't necessarily know the quality of what we find, but we can find information, and there is now more and more good quality information available to people for free, through the internet and through web-based platforms. Information consumption to participatory learning. This is the whole web 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, wherever we are now. People do not want passive experiences of you telling me what is right. They want to be engaged in their own learning. They want to be makers. They want to be able to build on what is known and make it yet more true and more real. So when we do formation programming, and programming is not all bad, it's important, we need to be sure it's engaging. Last night when I did the 20 questions, I did that on purpose, not only to keep you awake at night because it was after dinner and I know with the fatigue, I also did it so you would remember and be connected with the wisdom that is in the room and begin to build with each other the learning that we were sharing. There were much richer stories coming from you than if I had done all of the talking and all of the example setting. The other adaptive challenge we face is that we're moving from a world of institutions to networks. So while the building you occupy as church or school is very important, the networks that you can impact from that building and the networks you can establish are even more important because people are transient, people have connections all over the world. As people who honor you as a leader and worship in your congregation and trust that place, what is the good news of that place that you can equip them to share with their extended family, with their networks of influence through the means that they already use, whether it's Facebook or social, other forms of social media? How can this good news, that's why lots of churches are using podcasts, right? To begin to tell the story of, but too many of our churches say we're podcasting and all they're really doing is uploading sermons. I mean, there's nothing wrong with a good uploaded sermon. But what can you wrap around an uploaded sermon that's a kind of engaging commentary that reflects the ethos of your congregation so that someone listening to it in Afghanistan or somebody listening to it on the West Coast hears something really interesting and intriguing that causes them to want to ask further big questions? How can you set up the sermon so that people understand why that sermon was preached or what the critical question is that the sermon is going to leave you with? What action can you challenge people to take because of it at the end of the sermon? So we have the abundance available now of digital resources. These three circles say abundance of mobile technologies, abundance of digital content, and abundance of digital tools. There is more out there than any of us can possibly know or manage. And there are people who can help you find your way to the right resources, the quality content. And before you say to me, yeah, but there's age divisions, and yeah, there's economic divisions. All that's true. This graph, though, will tell you, it's from the Pew Internet folks, and they do the best research on this. Currently, what percent of American adults are online by age? The black top line, you will not be surprised, are the 18 to 29-year-olds. 98% of them are currently online. The blue line, 30 to 49%, 92% are online. This is across all classes of people. Green line, 50 to 64, 83% of people are currently online. And in the 65 plus, 56% of us are already online. And it's only going up. So There is still a digital divide, there is no question, but it is much less than we have ever thought it was. There are rural communities that are more, they have more broadband access than many of our metropolitan communities. Our metropolitan communities have libraries. There are places that people go to be online. The fastest growing ethnic demographic with digital mediated work is the Hispanic Latino community. They use smartphones and digital devices at rates far beyond Anglo-Caucasian communities. And it's not, you know, clearly there's a correlation. There is more money in Anglo communities still generally, broadly, than there are in many Latino communities. But that access has given them possibilities in terms of employment, in terms of networking, in terms of advocacy, and they've chosen to invest and learn and make that possible. So who owns these devices by age? The biggest column are cell phone users, cell phone owners. So all age groups, all demographics are above 65% of ownership. The third over are smartphone users. So the numbers go down. The green column being the 65 plus, in 2014, less than 20% of 65 plus year olds were using smartphones. Now, the next generation of smartphones are coming out with larger faces, larger they're more accessible to people with older eyes, with less agile hands. Things like the Apple Watch, all sorts of devices are coming that are going to make real-time digital resourcing and digital tools available to people of all ages with adaptive technology. So social networks by age. I don't know why they didn't keep the same color. So yellow on the right is black on the left. But just so you know, the 18 to 29 year olds, this is the percent that are using social networks on a regular basis, 90%, no surprise. But 65 plus, 46% of 65-year-olds and above are using social networks regularly. Okay, that's pretty significant. When you look at it as a pie chart, it's not, I mean, the younger generation is the largest piece of the pie, right? The gold or the yellow, but it's not that much more than the 65-plus-year-olds. So it's 17% to 32%. That's pretty close when you think about how quickly that divide is closing. So we have technologies, there are many more than are on this slide, that allow us to be mobile and have access to the internet. What that means is people can be connected to your church, your school, your ministry, wherever they are and whenever they want to be. It matters what we are providing in the way of communication and content for that purpose. We can push out good information, and we can receive back real-time engagement, prayer requests, concerns, ideas, feedback. I know vestries that don't meet physically together anymore because they live in metropolitan areas, and the traffic demands were so stressful that the quality of the meeting was compromised. They meet now with Google Hangout, which is an online web free service for seeing and hearing and watching each other. The agenda is posted, and they meet with Google, and people are meeting from their office, from their home. They pray, they study scripture, and they have their meeting with Google Hangout. And then they have a physical retreat once or twice a year when they spend a concentrated amount of time together. That, to me, in some settings, is using technology well. It's good stewardship. It's practicing faithfully what it means to be the people of God, honoring the gifts of people's time and their capacity to engage in the work that they're called to do. I know lots of people who have mentoring relationships, confirmation programs, where an adult is mentoring a young person. They have met face to face, they know each other, but they have an arranged digital relationship, whatever that is. They have an approved text relationship. The parents know they have each other's phone numbers. They know that they can text, or they have a time when they get on, they log on, and they Skype, or they web conference with each other. They may only live 2 miles apart, but they do it at a time that's convenient for both of them. And there's something about being able to do that from the space you choose that is very comforting for the young person. I have a number of godchildren, and I Skype with them, and I hang out, I do FaceTime with them for those who have Apple phones. We talk to each other, and you know, one of my godsons just the other day sent me a text, "Can I talk to you right now?" And I said, "Sure." And 2 seconds later, I got a FaceTime invitation, you know, and he needed to ask me a question. And it was just like, it was a 30-second, 45-second conversation, and we said, goodbye, I love you, and I hung up, you know. That privilege of maintaining relationships with people as pastors, as individuals, is real. So think about the resources that are available to you. When it comes to content, there are many, many places to draw from, but these are just three. You all know about TED, right? So the TED Talks that have become so famous, ideas worth spreading. TED Talks are uneven, but there are many that are really good. And there's TEDx, there's TED Education. There are all sorts of channels within the TED universe that provide extraordinary content in 17-minute videos that have already been given. People have already created written curriculum or wraparound conversation pieces for them, or it takes very little time for you who's found the subject matter you care about, the provocative speaker you want people to listen to then wrap around that some thoughtful, engaging biblical study, prayer practice, deep questions. If you find a TED Talk on a topic that people in your congregation want to learn and want to discover, you could send in an old-fashioned email the link to that talk, two really pithy questions, and say, when you come to church on Sunday, have watched this, have thought about these questions, and we're going to start talking about it. Or you could get a little bit more ambitious and create a Facebook group. Post all of this in the Facebook group. Encourage people to watch it. Encourage people to post. You comment. You respond. Give people a chance to engage with this content on the business trip, while they're nursing their baby, while they're sitting with a dying loved one. Let them have a chance to be engaged in learning with you from a distance at their convenience. But put some parameters around it. Say, this is going to happen this week or this month, and there will be an endpoint, and we will be checking in. It's not just sending it out and hoping and wishful thinking that they'll engage. It's following up with that accountability. It's expecting them to do something. It's asking them to push and grow. And then asking them for suggestions. Church Next is an Episcopal priest who has started a collection of educational videos on almost every topic you could think of related to Christian life in the church. And you can register, and for a cost that's really very reasonable, as an individual, study these subject areas or build a class. Yes?
We have a diocesan subscription.
There you go.
That gives you, I think, 60%, 50%
off. So you have a diocesan subscription, which will reduce the cost significantly. You can build a course around a number of videos. You can do something on the prayer book, or you could do something on on the Bible, for sure. There's a whole lot of Bible scholars that are speaking. You take these videos. In some cases, the lesson plans and the curriculum have been written around them already, and more are being posted. But there's just really good content already there. It's been vetted. So consider that. And then there's the Logos Project. This is from the Diocese of Texas. There's just a lot of good resources out there. Don't be shy. If you don't know where to go looking, feel free to come to the Center of Ministry for Teaching, and we'll help you find it. iTunes, those of us in the you know, Mac, Apple universe, it is one of the many go-to places for free university courses. What's great there, too, is you can find good content, you can make that material your own, and you can give it to people so they can learn about it and with it and engage it on your own device. Maybe it's you who wants to learn. Maybe you're feeling burned out. Maybe you're feeling like, I'm the last person in the universe who knows nothing about fill in the blank. See if there's a course on iTunes. Take it. There is a resource I know less about, but a colleague of mine, Dorothy Linthicum, who's been doing a lot of work on spirituality of aging, highly recommends. And it is a website called Chaplains on Hand. And it's, you can't see much of it here, but the gist of this website is that it is a trusted website for individuals who are relatively disconnected from formal church communities to find trained chaplaincy services for issues at critical points in their human life. So on this website, you can find counsel about chronic illness. You can find counsel about end of life. You can find counsel about coping with a loved one who is living with mental illness. You can find support, and you can submit prayer requests. It is a resource that you should know about. It's a resource that you might want to make available and participate in some way in your congregation. But it is one of many quality resources online that people are finding their way to who are not yet finding us. So it's an intermediate stop, perhaps, but it is a place that encourages people to find a local faith community to sustain the life of prayer and faith in times of transition and in times of need. We all know Forward Movement, the little books, right? How many of you know that you can subscribe to Forward Movement online? And you can get a daily meditation to you online. You can just get it, read it, it's portable. It can be on the metro on the way to work. It can be waiting in the school line, picking up kids at school. It's something to tell your congregations and your school parents and your other folks that you influence that they might want to subscribe to this. But not only can you get it, you can engage it. So the next step is they make it, do you want to say something? I bet many, how many of you have ever written for Forward Movement day by day? Several of us, okay, a few of us. Someone wrote, Peggy Nash wrote, May? Penny Nash. Is she here? Nope. Okay, so she's a current author of this, which makes it even more fun, right? But what I want you to know is that it's a good example. This is Forward Movement, and they have really decided to kind of take the resources of a proven, trusted resource and make them more available to people using digitally mediated means. And so you can just get it online because it's easy, but you can then also engage in the reflective process. And that's something you could easily offer to adults in your community as a resource for them and encourage their formation. And you didn't have to do the work, right? It's quality, it's trusted. This is Scott Gunn, who is the director of Forward Movement, is also one of the famous folks now with Lent Madness. Does that ring a bell? So, Episcopal priest. So Forward Movement also is famous now for Lent Madness. And if you don't know what Lent Madness is, it's a crazy popular experience of going through Lent. Instead of doing March Madness, you are voting on saints every day. So you get to pick between two saints, you get their biography, and you get to say the game today is between Hildegard of some Bingen and, you know, some pick another random saint, and you just get to read their biography and vote because you care, you think this dude was better than that woman, or you think she was fabulous, and you didn't know that, you know, her whole mystical experience began with, you know, an acorn, or whatever you want to say. So what's really incredible, that was Julian Norwich, I realize. But what's really incredible about it is that it is a way of having people playfully engage with the saints. And all of us who've played March Madness at all in the last several years, I know more about saints of God and, you know, obscure saints that I'd never heard of than I ever would have known before. And it is a really fun mechanism. So a lot of parishes encourage people to just play. They have pools at church. They'll have the poster on the wall. All the mechanism, all the tchotchkes that come with it. You can get March Madness, you know, bling now. It's all over the place. But it's all just a fun way to get people to engage in formation. So Scott and his team have taken very seriously. Their job is not just to produce this little booklet we all love called, you know, Forward Movement Day by Day, but it's to help form disciples for ministry in the world. And these are two examples of their playfulness. Another community that many of you know is doing this very well, the monks up in, the Anglican Episcopal monks up in Boston, St. John the Evangelist. A friend of mine, Jamie Coates, who is actually their development director, but has in essence also therefore their communications coordinator, figured out that the monks produce this incredibly, extraordinarily deep amount of content every day. That's their vocation, right? To pray, to study, to teach. And for those of us privileged to go to their house, to be on retreat with them, to be there on the Charles River, it is transformative. Or to have one of them be our spiritual director, or a retreat leader for our vestry. Incredible. But there are only so many monks, and they can only get so far out in the world, and they can only do that so many times. So Jamie said, we've got to figure out a way to take this content and give it away. That's our vocation. So he began to create means by which the daily wisdom of the monks is shared with the world. So there are now so many wonderful ways that you can participate and learn from and engage with the brothers in Boston, in Cambridge. I highly recommend it to you. So I get Brother Give Us a Word on my phone every morning. It's the first thing I read. It is literally I don't have my phone here, so I can't show you today, but it is a word with about a sentence or two by one of the brothers that comes from something he has written or preached recently or in the past. And if that's all I have time for that day, that's what I get. It might be hope, it might be love, it might be forgiveness, it might be wonder. A little bit of a description that's inspirational in its own right. If I have time, I click through and I get the full resource. Then they're doing incredible stuff with video and Lenten series. We at the center have been working with them on the Lenten series, so we help write the curriculum to engage the video content. This one coming up next year is going to be called Digging Deeper. It was written by a seminarian spouse at our seminary, and it's going to be about how to build a rule of life in an ordinary, busy life that we all live. It's incredible. It uses agricultural metaphors and themes to talk about sustaining the earth and sustaining our spiritual journeys. Word today is death. So if you're curious, go online, ssje.org. Highly recommended. So we form faith. We need to be forming it lifelong and life-wide. We need to be thinking intergenerationally and generationally. We need to be thinking about networked approaches, not doing this alone, building networks of shared learning that cross geography, cross time. We need to think about in missional terms. That's a word that I go back and forth about, but the basic idea is that we are people with a mission. We are called to bring about the unity of all people with God through Christ. We need to be thinking about forms of formation and education that are connected and blended. When I say connected and blended, I mean gathered time as well as ways that we connect using digital devices or ways that we connect by mail, ways that we blend resources and formats. We need to build, we've got all these building blocks. We do not need to start again. We do not need to reinvent the wheel. We do not need to feel alone. There are such incredible resources to make what we are already doing richer. And yes, what we do needs to be personalized. People need to feel when they experience what we are offering as church, that what it is we can give them matters to them right now as who they are and with the life questions and the issues that they're asking. So we need to translate. We need to be good deacons, all of us. We need to be able to translate the church to the world and the world to the church. We know we have this great promise to offer. But if people can't understand it and don't receive it well, we, in fact, are disappointing them, and we become irrelevant, and we are failing God in the very vocation that we inherited at the font. And our forming faith needs to be curated. So we are the people leading, as clergy and lay leaders, we are the people who are saying, here are some trusted resources. Here are some things that are out there, they're available. I want to share them with you because I, who you trust, has found them, and now I want to give them to you. So this is just a slide to say the Center for the Ministry of Teaching and I and my amazing team are available to you. You can find us by just getting to the VTS website and look for the Center for the Ministry of Teaching. But in particular, there's one website that I should put in white here that I would love for you to be able to go to and follow us or join us on our various sites. You will not be inundated. We will not send you a lot of junk mail. We will not ask you for money. But we will give you updates about the work that we're doing. And you can choose the various platforms of ours that you might want to follow. But that is vts.edu/CMT, that's Center for the Ministry of Teaching, /connect. So vts.edu/CMT/connect. And right there, you can subscribe to Episcopal Teacher, which is our quarterly free magazine for people involved in Christian education. You'll get that digital form of that. You can subscribe to Building Faith, which is our incredibly rich resource site for all things Christian education for all ages, including new downloadable single-page PDFs for Building Faith at Home that are for households of all types, single people, couples, people with children, people with grown children. They are practices that are accessible and enduring for you to practice faith in everyday life around events of your life. So go to buildingfaith.org and you'll find those resources. And then we have Keyhole Online, which is our website that has more in-depth reflections and reviews of current resources. But all of it's archived, All of it's there. If you want to know the podcasts we think are great and listen to, you can find those. But we're there to help you. Lifelong and LifeWide is for all people, all shapes, all sizes. And I think if we do it well, they will all be smiling. I really do believe that. And my real dream is that our epic adventure, our epic truth that we know can be seen, can be heard in all ways, in ways we speak, in ways we act, and in ways we witness indirectly through all of these profound means of communication available to us today. So say with me, Christ has died, Christ is risen, and Christ will come again. Amen.